Hello and welcome to this Q&A episode of the ESG Fitness Podcast and live into Commit to Six group. Shona, how are you?
I am great, thanks, Emma. How are you?
I am very well, thank you. Andy, how are you?
Good, thank you. Good. Loving life, as always.
Living the dream.
Yeah.
Hey, Kaylee. Okay, should we get on with questions? Because we have very, very, very many.
There is 94 comments in this thread.
Holy shit biscuits.
Yeah.
But so just to explain, guys, like what we've been doing is going through the comments and any that are sort of better answered with like a link to something or just us answering them, then we've done that. And then any that need exploring on the podcast, we've left for the podcast.
Yep. Yeah, that's a good idea. Okay, so first up, it's Siobhan. I know it's possible to simultaneously build muscle and lose fat when you're a newbie to lifting weights, but at what point is this no longer possible? Can you still continue to build muscle while in a deficit so long as you have potential stored energy? Brackets fat.
In brackets, fat. I love when people call fat stored energy. I just think that's
Fat
great.
retention.
Yeah, a little bit of fat retention, a little bit of energy retention.
That's it.
Do you want me to go first?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so I did what I think is a very nice little infographic on this. And basically, there isn't like a finite period of time. It's not like after 6 weeks you will stop losing. Sorry, you will stop building muscle at the same time as losing fat. Like, it's just the likelihood becomes less and less and less the more experienced you become at lifting weights. So there is this like honeymoon phase where you've got quite a lot of body fat to lose and your muscles are very newly sensitive to the stimulation of exercise, where you drastically see this as well. Like, we as coaches see this where it's quite obvious that you've lost fat and built muscle at the same time. Other situations when that occur is if you have, I don't know, not exercised very much for a period of time and put on a load of weight, like a load of people might have done during lockdown, and then you go back to the gym, start eating better, you end up building muscle and losing fat at the same time. It's much harder to do that the more experienced you become and the less body fat you have. So it's not so much that you'd have so little body fat that you couldn't use it to build muscle. It's just it's much less likely to happen. One hypothesis is that when your muscle cells are very stretched, they become very insulin resistant, which means they're almost pushing energy away, and your muscles are so sensitive and newly stimulated and very insulin sensitive that they're like pulling energy in, and that's sort of this like perfect storm situation. Now, if you think about what's causing that, i.e., very stretched and full fat cells, as you lose fat, they're going to become less stretched, less full, less insulin resistant, which for your health is exactly what you want. But it does mean that it's much less likely for that situation to continue. So in a way, it's a marker of like, as much as it's a nice period of time when you're able to lose fat and build muscle at the same time, it's kind of a marker that you're like progressing in your body composition that is no longer happening, or not to the same extent. Like, it's not to say it won't happen at all, it's just that it will be a slower process.
Fabulous. Shall we just move on to the next question? Because I don't think me and Andy have anything to add to that. I would be like, yes. Next question. Right, okay, here we go. From Zoe, you often talk about recovery. Obviously, I know what it is in theory, but would like to know more about how it looks in practice. I assume it's sleep, fuel, etc. But how do you know when you're sufficiently recovered? Would the only way to know to be to try something different and see if you feel any change? For example, try getting an hour more sleep and see if you feel better when training the next day. So that's part one of the question, and then second part is also, does the menstrual cycle affect recovery? So what works 1 week may not be enough for the next, and if so, should you ever adjust your training schedule for this, or just accept that you may sometimes not be able to lift as heavy slash as many reps? Ooh.
Very good question.
Yeah.
I think for the first part of that one, there isn't really anything that you can work out about your recovery levels apart from yourself. So,
but
you
Andy,
know,
what about a whoop band?
I don't start on this balls.
What is the whoop band, like the strain thing?
Yeah, I think, and like Emil's quite obsessed with his ring. He's got like an aura ring that like tells him how ready he is for the day and stuff.
See, I think that's one of those ones that's like, if you have something like that and it tells you that you're feeling pish, you're going to feel crap for the rest of the day.
Yep.
Whereas if you just get up and go, I'm a bit tired, I'm going to burn it, I'm going to work it off and I'm feeling good again. I think the biggest, or one of the biggest indicators of recovery is how you feel. Like, is wake up in the morning, I maybe didn't sleep very well last night. And you should be able to understand that and like kind of realize that. When it comes to stuff like training, you'll see that you're under-recovered if you are not being able to push as the heavy weights as you were previous sessions. And then you just maybe need to sort of play around with stuff at that point. Maybe it's the fact that you had a broken night's sleep. Maybe it's the fact that you didn't eat, or you ate a bit further away from your training session. You know, just little things like that are sometimes it's nice to keep a little diary about like how you've been feeling and stuff, like how your tiredness levels are. But again, I wouldn't read too much into it because people get so hung up on these things and they start freaking out. Like, I know a few folk that have got whoop bands and it's like, oh my God, my recovery level is only 8%. Well, you should really be dead if it's only 8%. Like, you know, you shouldn't be doing anything. The only thing you should be doing is like lying in bed at that point. So, you know, and again, we just don't know what the algorithm is that they use for this kind of stuff. We can't, you know, you kind of get a rough estimate on things like heart rate and stuff, but like, how are they monitoring it and what are they doing to be able to tell you that you're not recovered?
Mm. Just on the menstrual cycle thing, kind of similar to what you're saying, Andy. So I have never, ever in my whole training life, and I don't know if you have, Emma, tracked my menstrual cycle in terms of like how I perform. And I almost wonder if it would make a difference, or would it have that sort of opposite, like nocebo effect of me thinking, oh, well, this week I'm going to be like not very good in the gym, so I'm just not really going to try that hard. And what do you think about that, Iman?
I have tracked it. I think it's quite hard because, to be honest, other factors are more influential than that.
Yeah.
So you might be thinking, oh, you know, this is the week I'm meant to be strongest, but actually, like, you tend to have like other life things going on, or like literally the smallest thing is probably going to have a bigger impact than your menstrual cycle. Now, for some people, it does seem to have a bigger impact than for others. Just like for some people, like PMS symptoms are much worse than others. So it's not to say that it won't affect anyone. And it certainly does, from a physiological perspective, have an effect. Mm. It's just that we need to always question the magnitude of that effect. Yeah. And like, I completely agree. I think Andy did a post on this last week, not on the menstrual cycle, but about like listening to your body as opposed to just looking at like data from different places. The one thing I will say in that question, you sort of asked like, should I try maybe increasing my sleep by an hour and seeing if I train better the next day? This is the problem. It would need to be like long term. So for example, when I said I tracked my menstrual cycle, I did it for like 3 cycles, which is nowhere near enough. Like, you would need like data over a year really to see that it wasn't just some other life event that was happening during that week, or you were stressed or tired, or you had commit to six starting so you didn't sleep as well. Like, there are so many things that would be more influential to me than this the stage of the cycle that I'm in. So that's one aspect, and the other is like, getting 1 hour's more sleep is probably going to have absolutely no effect on your performance the next day. However, if you got an extra hour of sleep every night for 2 weeks, you might start to see your performance increasing if you weren't having enough before. Like, it's a longer term thing that you would need to look at it as. I also think as well, like, sometimes I'll get very little sleep and I actually perform better the next day, not just from a physical perspective, but like a mental perspective. And I notice that quite a lot. And you always think, oh, I've got away with this. Like, I actually feel great. But it's usually like the next day or the day after, you're like,
I think that's because you are so determined to not be affected by lack of sleep that it actually...
Like, I don't need any sleep. I am Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah.
I've had that the last two nights, so I've got an... Well, we've got an unwell dog at the moment, which has been having to get up at, like, 3:30 in the morning to go out and do its business. So, but I've... Like, the last 2 days, I've been wired. Like, literally, I've had probably the least caffeine I've had in a long time in the last 2 days, and I'm buzzing. So... I do think a lot of it as well, though, is I think it's just your mindset about this kind of stuff. Like, you know, if that's one of the reasons why I always try to get people to think about how they're actually feeling from, like, gut instinct, is the fact that, you know, as soon as you get one of those, one of my clients had the thing on their phone about telling them how well they slept and how broken their sleep was and how many times they woke up during the night and all this kind of stuff. And that actually stressed them out more than... It's like, you've been doing this, you've been sleeping like this for years, it's never affected you until you started looking at this data, and now you're freaking out, and now you're not sleeping. So, like, take it away, don't overthink too much. I think because we've got so much technology nowadays, it's so easy to get taken down that rabbit hole of overthinking about stuff that, you know, your gut is going to give you a much better indicator of.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think when everyone read that book by Matthew Walker, like the sleep book, and everyone was just stressed out that they weren't getting enough sleep, and it was like actually exacerbating the problem, because most people know if they're not getting enough sleep already, like, yeah, I've got a kid like who gets up 5 times a night, like, that at the moment there's nothing, it's not like a choice that I'm choosing to have very little sleep, like, I just can't do anything about it at the moment. And then you read all this stuff about how lack of sleep is killing us, or, like, you know, all the wrecking your metabolism. It's like all this stuff. And you're like, how is this helpful? Now, I'm not only getting woken up by my child every night, but between those times, I'm lying in bed awake worrying that I'm not sleeping.
Yeah. Guess who didn't read that book? And guess who doesn't have sleep problems?
I read it, but I also don't have sleep problems.
I think a lot of it as well is, like, this kind of stuff, you can take as much of this information as you want and action as much of it as you want, or find what works for you and just disregard the rest. Mm. I think people get, you know, it's one of those ones about, like, you know, the whole self-help book style stuff, is that, like, if you're reading 500 self-help books, you've learned nothing from the first one. Like, you're, because generally they're all very similar. Like, it's like your post about resonating with coaches, Emma. Like, we all do the same things, and it's about what resonates with you. So reading 500 self-help books, you've not found one that resonates
but
with you.
There
so
are,
you need
yeah, to- I agree with this. I was thinking about it this morning, and, like, obviously I stand by what I said, which was effectively, like, go with a coach that you resonate with, because any decent coach is going to be giving you very similar information. But
yeah,
decent coach is, like, yes, the kind of crux of it there. And also, like, some coaches, even if they mean to do well, can cause harm by the way that they word things. And like, to some extent, I think that's, like, the client's responsibility to be like, that's quite triggering for me, or I'm noticing that my attitude towards food since working with this person has decreased now, or, like, it has been hampered in some way. Now, yeah, that might work for, like, most people, but for you, it's not working. So you need to, like, take the responsibility and move on and like, find a different coach. And then when I was thinking about that, I was like, actually, I think people often do that too often or too quickly, because it takes, like, you guys all know, like, so the people you now have on committed from the last intake, you kind of getting to know them now because you've worked with them for 6 weeks.
Yeah.
The new intake, you don't really know any of them. It takes time to get to know someone. And every time you jump on a new program or start with a new coach, you're starting from square one again. You need to build a relationship with that coach. And when you get the best results is when you have the best relationship with your coach. And also when you feel like you can be honest with them and say, like, you know, I'm having these feelings, or, like, I've been extremely stressed and actually I'm emotionally eating quite a lot at the moment. Like, is there something we can do about this? Like, being able to open up with your coach is so important, and you can't get that from the start. Like, it takes time to develop that relationship. And I honestly don't know how people can be asked to move coach. Like, I don't want to start from the start. I want someone who knows me. I want someone who I don't need to explain everything to again. to start again with someone else. Like, I get that there are situations when that is necessary, but they should be minimized. And that's why you should think about who, you know, you shouldn't just like willy-nilly flip between programs, but also have a think about who you're actually signing up with in the first place. Like, get to know them first before you sign up, which is also why I'm so happy that so many people who signed up to Commit to the Six this time have been like, oh, I've been listening to the podcast for months. And you're like, right, you guys already know us. Now it's our job to get to know you a little bit. Like, there's already a bit of rapport, and plus you kind of know our approach, how we're going to speak. We know that we already resonate with each other. That's a really good starting point.
Definitely.
So well done for doing your research.
Let's have a nice comment from Nikki as a small interlude to the questions. Not a question, but more an observation. I've been on many different programs and diet plans, each with their own private social media pages and the usual sticky issues that come with them. But in all that time, I've never come across such a supportive, friendly and welcoming group of like-minded people, each with their own goals and experiences. It's only technically day two, but already the supportive messages of encouragement from this group by far exceeds anything I've experienced before. You're all a pretty awesome bunch. Thanks, Nikki.
Oh, that's so nice.
Isn't it?
It's also so true. Like, every time we start a new group, we're always like in our coaching chat, like, oh my God, I love this group. It's so good. Like, everyone's so excited. But yeah, it's such a lovely group. So supportive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that comes from, like, you know, the people that have been on it for the longest. Like, the folk who have been on Committed for however many. In fact, when was the first time? When did you open Committed? Because it's obviously.
There's people that have been on for over a year.
Yeah, so like, you know, they very much
the OGs
they back up and sort of bring that community. And I think it's something that comes across in the feedback from when we finish up the Commit to Six feedback, is that the group is just it's something else. And it's true, like, you know, and it's you guys that do it, is the people supporting each other, helping each other, answering, supporting, and, you know, it's you guys make it. You know, we're just here. To be fair, we generally get to a question and there's been 15 answers on it already. And I think you put one up yesterday, Emma, did you not? You went, I actually can't answer this any better than anybody else. Well done.
Yeah. I mean, if we've got nothing to add, there's no point saying something just for the sake of it.
Yeah, totally.
And yeah, with that question in particular, everyone who was answering had literally gone through what this person was going through. So yeah. There's no point adding any extra, and I just love that about this group. Okay, next question from Kirsten. I'm doing the home dumbbell workouts. Joining a gym or buying more equipment aren't viable options for me at the moment. Not sure that my dumbbells are heavy enough for the lower body exercises. Today I increased the weights as much as I could for the single leg deadlifts, reverse lunges and squats, and then simply added on an extra set to almost failure. Is this the right way to go about it? As my upper body is weaker, I don't have this issue with the upper body workout. Haven't really worked out like this before, so not quite sure what I'm meant to be doing in terms of progressive overload. So yeah, she's only got like limited dumbbells. How does she progressively overload?
Exactly what she's done, really. She's kind of nailed it. Like, there are limitations to only having a certain amount of weight at home. It doesn't mean that you can't get results or you can't train, but like, is it optimal? Probably not, but equally that you have to work with what you've got. And depending on your goals, like, would it be, if you said, you know, I want to compete in the next WBFF bikini lineup, or I don't know, you had like huge aspirations of putting on a load of muscle, then I'd be like, I think you need to join the gym or buy some heavier dumbbells. If you want to improve your body composition, then you don't need to do either of those. Like, you don't need to be training at your absolute pinnacle max to get the results that you're looking for.
Yeah.
Great. I know that to build muscle, you generally have to be in a surplus after newbie gains. Is there an optimal percentage of weight gain when in a hypertrophy phase?
What do you think, Andy?
Yeah, the problem is again, this is the question that you get the answer of, it depends. Depends on how big your surplus is, depends on a whole matter of different things. You know, the issue is I think the biggest issue with people thinking about a surplus is how big a surplus that they freak out at. So I think whenever somebody hears a surplus, they're like, oh my God, I'm going to have to eat like 700 calories more a day. When in actual fact, a surplus of 50 calories a day, you're still in a surplus. You just are in a slightly smaller surplus. But yeah, I've lost the question. I'm trying to read.
Optimal percentage of weight gain when in hypertrophy. Easy for me to say.
The hypertrophy. I always get this question. I just feel like your life must be so boring to actually care about this. But they're always like, is it hypertrophy or hypertrophy? And I'm like, I don't care. Like, I think it's just one way that, like, maybe Americans say it one way and we say it another. I tend to, like, go between, but I've never heard of hypertrophy. Because I quite like that one.
Can it's
I
like just tell aluminum you? And aluminium. Hypertrophy.
No, Americans say aluminium. Aluminium. They say aluminum. They miss out letters.
Yeah.
That's just wrong.
You just did that. Hypertrophy.
Hypertrophy.
Can I just tell you something slightly interesting that's not really interesting at all? My mum pronounces the T in mortgage. Mortgage says mortgage. But then doesn't pronounce the T in Waitrose and says Waitrose.
Hey, okay, that is interesting.
Selective T's.
Yeah, and I'm like, how can you make Waitrose sound not posh? Waitrose.
Well, you know, like when you get your car valeted.
Yeah.
But most people say valet.
Valet. Mm-hmm. I think you do say valeted.
It's valeted.
But some people do say valet.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the same. It's quite funny because, like, obviously, I think a lot of it just depends on, like, the area that you're from, how you pronounce this stuff. But I'm the same as you. I go between hypertrophy and hypertrophy quite regularly just to annoy people.
Sometimes I notice I do that with adaptation and adaption.
No, that's a different word.
Yeah, but I use them interchangeably. They're the same to me.
Sean is mum, Emma.
Plot twist.
Right, did we answer that question?
No, I can't remember what it was. Oh, okay, yeah. I mean, I guess more broadly, the question is, what should I expect when it comes to weight gain when I'm in a hypertrophy phase? And I think initially, at least, and Andy's right, like, it depends on numerous factors. Also, one of them would be, like, how much body fat you already have and if you need to put on more weight or not. Like, some people can do a hypertrophy phase without really putting on much weight because they already are in, like, they've got enough body fat and they just need to be in a very slight, if any, surplus. Like, you could probably do it maintenance. What's kind of frustrating is that when you say that, someone who's excessively lean will be like, great, so I don't need to put on any weight to put on muscle. And it's like, no, that won't work for you because you're very lean. You need to put on more weight. And I actually did a full podcast on this. I think it's called, like, What to Expect When Gaining Muscle. So I would listen to that, but it goes through different circumstances. Like, I used myself an example. I put on, like, 8 pounds, but I was still quite lean. So 8 pounds seems like a lot, but I'm still putting on now. So I put on maybe about 12 now since my leanest, which sounds like, and for some people that's completely unnecessary, but depending on the level of lean that you got to, is necessary. So 12 pounds to someone might completely freak them out, but it's not like, it's not the magnitude of weight, it's kind of more your body composition and where you want to sit. Now I will get to a phase, which I'm about at, where I'll just probably sit around maintenance and iterate a little bit to sort of maintain where I am. But yeah, that would be my response. Very individual.
Mm. Helen's got another question. I'm hoping to get back into the gym in the next couple of weeks and wondering how best to combine this with home workouts. She just has bands at home. I'm aiming for 4 workouts a week at the moment. If I can get to the gym once or twice a week, what should I focus on while I am there? Would a full body gym workout be the best way to maximise my time there? Okay, so I will go first. I think, just on a practical point, see, when we all get back into the gym, there's going to be so many rules in place. You'll have like a certain amount of time that you're allowed to be there. You won't be able to like hang around and like take loads of equipment. So I would probably go for the things that you definitely don't have at home and that you definitely can get access to, but also have like a backup plan, because you don't want to be like there and thinking, oh shit, like I had like back squat, leg press, whatever, deadlift on my plan, but I can't get any of that stuff. So make sure that you've got a backup list. So yeah, I would probably go for a full body, because then if you like can't get access to something, then you can just maybe move on to the next exercise on your list. What do you think?
I think it's also the gym. I think a lot of people think that gyms are going to be quiet. I actually think the gyms are going to be absolutely hoaching. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be people have found fitness over
hoaching.
I think people have found fitness over lockdown, with whether it be running or Joe Wicks workouts or whatever it is. And I think people are actually going to start getting to the point where we're going to see people who have never been in a gym in their life are going to start setting foot in a gym because they want to get fitter, fitter, stronger, whatever it is they're looking for. I just can't wait for, personally, I just can't wait to get a leg extension and a leg curl back in, because I'm at the point now where I'm about to puke any time I'm going to squat, because I'm sick to death of squatting. Like, it's shit.
Yeah, guys, it's been so hard for Andy, like, owning a gym and, like, having access to a gym the whole time. So if we could just think about the fact he's not been able to get on the hamstring curl.
My hamstrings are lagging, though.
What about lying banded hamstring curl, eh?
I've not got heavy enough bands for that. Black band, smashing.
I can't speak today. Boss.
Okay, Shayna, thanks for that. I think the only thing I would have to add is I completely agree with Shayna, and I think a really good idea is like knowing alternatives. So if you can't get on the leg press, what is the movement pattern you're doing there? It's a heavy squat.
Yeah.
You can heavy squat instead, like, or you can grab a weight or something. The things that I would probably focus on are legs and upper body pull, because they're much harder to do at home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So like loading your legs, especially if like one of the first questions was, you know, I struggle with reaching failure on my lower body because I only have X amount of dumbbells at home. It's kind of easier to reach failure on your upper body, especially with push movements, because you can do a load of push-ups. Like, you don't really need to, if you're looking at hierarchy of needs here, like doing push-ups is going to be just as good as doing bench press. Nope, you don't need to do that in your very limited time at the gym. What you can't do is leg extensions. What you can't do is heavy squats or heavy leg press or potentially lat pull down, like heavy rows, something like that, that's actually you might not have the equipment to do or the setup to do at home. So I would prioritize the things that you struggle to hit at home in a kind of full body type way. So if I was only having one session at the gym, I'd do legs and back, or like legs and pull.
That's a really good point, especially because we had like a million questions about how to recreate like a pull-up for people at home. So yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah, we've done that.
Yeah, we have. We've answered that question
banded
a lot.
Pull.
Banded pull, yeah. Okay, so that's definitely a question for Emma. I've been trying to read up on the role of insulin and insulin resistance. I listened to Emma's podcast on it. Found it very interesting. Is there a benefit of intermittent fasting to support fat loss? Does it help if you are insulin resistant? How would you know if you were insulin resistant?
Yeah, I think this is a problem. So you're almost definitely not insulin resistant if you're exercising frequently and you're not obese on a BMI. Like, there are certain circumstances where you might be slightly more insulin resistant. It's quite unlikely. Like, all the things that you would do to increase your insulin sensitivity, we've already told you to do. Like, stay active. Don't spend a huge amount of time sitting down and being sedentary. Resistance train. You know, eat within your needs for your... If you're losing fat, like, that's going to make you more insulin resistant. I mean, sorry, more insulin sensitive as well. So people kind of overcomplicate this, and you're already doing all the right things, so don't stress about it. The only way you would know if you were insulin resistant is to do probably an oral glucose tolerance test, or what's called a HOMA, or HMA. Anyway, it's like an acronym. But you would be like in, have a blood test and see how much insulin you're producing compared to the glucose that you're intaking. Completely unnecessary. In fact, I think they only do that in research now, mainly because it takes 2 hours to do. So essentially you're given like a shot of glucose, so that might be Lucozade or something, and then they measure how you're responding to that in terms of your blood glucose levels, how long it takes to spike and how long it takes to come down, and how well you're able to handle the glucose load. You wouldn't ever really have that test done, so I wouldn't worry about it. Mostly what they do, if they're worried about you being type 2 diabetic, which is caused by insulin resistance, is they would have your fasting glucose taken to see if your fasting levels were elevated. And then they might look at what's called an HbA1c, which kind of shows you how your glucose control has been over the last sort of month or so. So those would be the blood tests that you get done at your doctor's if they were worried that you were type 2 diabetic. If not, they're not going to do those tests. Like, it's kind of irrelevant data that you don't need to worry about. The other thing I would say is that everyone's response to even the same foods can be quite different. So that's another factor. But my point is, like, I find it interesting, but it's not something that anyone needs to worry about. So, yeah. Does that answer the question?
Yep. Well done. Okay. Moved to being in surplus calories to build muscle. Does this mean I will inevitably gain some fat too? I was pretty active before, so don't know if my energy expenditure would be any more than on previous lower calories. Any advice in gaining least amount of fat?
Did I comment under this with the podcast?
No.
No, it might be further down. I'll post it in the group as well, because there's a couple of questions which are all answered on kind of right. What to expect when gaining. And again, it depends. Like, it's the exact same answer that we just gave, really, is that if you're very lean, then you can expect to gain some body fat. If you're not excessively lean and you're probably in like a normal healthy range, probably don't need to gain much body fat. No, you can probably sit around maintenance, maybe erring on the side of a little bit of a surplus, and just work on fueling your workouts and recovering well from your workouts.
Yeah, I've got a client just now who is really lean, and she is just changed to hypertrophy phase, and as that, like, she had the exact same concern. And I mean, she's checking in week on week with me. If she ever gets to a point where she's not comfortable with how she looks when she looks in the mirror, then we just reduce the calories slightly, and it is so quick. As quickly as she gained it, as she'll quickly lose it. So that's why it's so good that you're in this position with us in Commit 6. So if you aren't happy with how things are going, we can just change it, and before long you'll be back to where you like.
That's why we check in every 2 weeks to make sure everything's on track, to make sure you're happy, to make sure things are going in the right direction. I would say with gaining that often I've felt uncomfortable gaining, and I've sort of just leaned into that. Like, the thing is, change is uncomfortable because your body is changing. You're like, oh, this isn't what I used to feel like. And so there is an element of being uncomfortable that I think that you should embrace to an extent.
Yeah.
But also, like, on a more practical note, and if you're sort of worried about this, like, listen to exactly what Shona said. Like, if you did end up, like, you're kind of picturing the worst case scenario is I put on a bit of fat, right? If you really decided you didn't want that fat, you now know how to lose it again. Like, we can help you do that. So I wouldn't be scared of pushing calories up for fear of putting on body fat, because worst case scenario, we lower them again. But equally, I wouldn't stop as soon as you feel uncomfortable, because sometimes you have to push through a little bit of uncomfort.
Absolutely. I love that phrase that everyone's using right now, lean into it.
Lean into it.
Yeah. Embrace it.
Get comfortable being uncomfortable.
Yeah. Nobody grows inside their comfort zone, Shona.
The irony is that you will be more comfortable because you'll be a bit more squishy, so you'll be nicer for cuddles.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
That's my excuse at the moment.
Yep. Mate, you're shredded.
No, at the moment I'm not.
It's all relative. Okay, so I struggle with fruit and veg. Are smoothies worth it to get fruit in? I don't necessarily enjoy them, but would get more fruit in this way if it was beneficial. That's from Lindsay.
The problem with using smoothies is the fact that you've destroyed or you've shredded all the fibre up, so you're not going to get the benefit of that. I think ideally you want to eat it because it's to do with satiety levels as well. So eating fruit and veg, you want to be able to have the food volume. Whereas if you make a smoothie out of it, your stomach's not going to take it in and it's not going to be as full. So you're going to be probably hungry again pretty quickly. So that's probably the reason why I would veer towards actually eating it rather than smoothifying it.
I agree. If you are going to do it, then use something like a NutriBullet, which I think is just a blender, as far as I know. Yep. The problem with smoothie is it takes out the pulp, and as Andy's saying, like, that's where a lot of the goodness is the fiber, so you don't want to get rid of that. It's not the end of the world if you blend it up and you like having it that way. Fine.
Yeah.
But you do miss, as Andy's saying, the satiety factor of is very, like, you can blend up a whole load of fruit that's like a big bowl of fruit and it turns into like quite a small glass. Imagine how much more full you would be if you'd actually eaten the fruit, and then you feel like you've eaten as opposed to feeling like you've had a drink.
Well, it's the same as like the innocent smoothies. Like, innocent smoothies, we've blended 5 million pieces of fruit.
Yeah.
It's like, what? Imagine you'd eaten that.
But they take out a lot of the pulp, I think.
They take out all the pulp and it's just absolute. I think they take out the pulp. They claim not to add any sugar in, but there seems to be more sugar than corresponding to the amount of fruit that's in it.
But I mean, like, all that, that's all that's left. If you've blended, however, you know, they're always like, there's 50 apples in this. And you're like, right, well, if you took all the sugar from 50 apples, took out all of the pulp and, like, goodness, you basically got sugary water.
Yeah. The 50 apples.
Of course, apples, it tastes nice.
That's a bloody tree.
I heard this story once about an innocent smoothie where someone had left their innocent smoothie in the car and it was a really hot day, and then the smoothie exploded all over the car. And then the person then complained to Innocent, and Innocent was like, the smoothie must have been really upset. You shouldn't have left it alone in the car.
You've got an angry apple.
Oh my God, do you know what I did the other day, which was like, it really, so I put, I just bought a can of Monster, but I like threw it in the front seat and it hit off something and it just went like, but it went on for ages because there was just like a tiny hole in it and it was like, shh, like all around the car. And I was like,
you made it angry.
Yeah. Do you remember BSN, so No Explode pre-workout?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So remember No Explode pre-workout, and like, I remember getting it, put it into my shaker, and I was on the way to the gym, and I was like, all right, I'll stop at Tesco and grab something to eat. So I'd shaken it up, left it in the car, and I got back in the car after having been in Tesco, and then I was like, hey, is my sunroof open? Because it seems to be raining in here. And the thing had exploded and was like dripping off the ceiling. Stuff was absolutely lethal. It was like all over the window. There was like hardly anything in the shaker.
It's mad, isn't it? And then like my whole car was like sticky.
Oh no. That's horrible. This is another question from Lindsay, and I wonder if this question would be answered if she just ate more fruit and veg. But here we go. So she says, vitamins, supplements needed, worth it. I tend to take a multivitamin, vitamin C, D, and B, magnesium and zinc before bed also. Also in the past have been suggested to take alpha lipoic acid after a workout, CLA. Beneficial or waste of time if some are, which I'm not sure that made any sense at all.
ALA, CLA are both got zippity do, no research or study or science behind them, so miss out on that. I think CLA is conjugated linoleic acid, and it's supposed to be something that helps you burn fat. It's supposed to help burn fat and increase your metabolism and stuff, but like all these stuff like ketones, etc., there is generally nothing to back it up. It's just good marketing more than anything else.
There's normally like some very soft science, like there is science behind it, which is why it can sound smart, but it's like that
obscure,
like, response has been saturated, like, way downstream of what you're looking at, so taking more and more and more of that doesn't benefit fat loss. Is usually the answer. And this is true with most supplements, or, like, I guess anything. It's like, often the response is saturated. It's like when people suggest a huge amount of protein and you're like, you're not going to get any more benefit from just having more and more and more and more. Like, some is important, but having more of it isn't going to be additionally better forevermore, like exponentially better even. So with vitamins, I find this question, like, it really questions me, because I do take a multivitamin knowing fine well that there's no evidence whatsoever to support it. And in my head, I'm like, kind of covers the bases. But there's actually, like, every single review that you read will say the best way to get in vitamins is to have a healthy, balanced diet, which I already have. But yeah, I still take a multivitamin.
Yeah, it's, it's exactly as you said, it's covering your bases.
But
just making
that's
sure
what's weird, though, like, that even that, like, it's completely pointless. I mean, I do get sent them free, so I just think,
would I
pay money for them is my point. I don't know.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. Vitamin D is probably one that we would suggest, because if you live in Scotland, you don't see much sun, that's for sure. And how random has the weather been here? Beautiful sunshine on Sunday where we could be sunbathing, and then yesterday it was snowing.
Mental.
I didn't even find that funny.
Oh, I think it's hilarious.
So people always say, like, this is a really simple example, right? So say you've got like a recommended daily allowance of vitamin C, and you don't want to go above that. But then, like, what happens if you ate tons of oranges that day? Would that be you also going above that?
You mean vitamin C?
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter for vitamin C, because it's water soluble, so you just pee it out.
Right, but say there was a bit, I don't know which
so
one.
So, like, vitamin D is fat soluble, so you can overdose on it.
Right,
it's very rare, and you would have to be really, like, piling it in. Like, I know people that take 10,000 IU a day, which is ridiculous, and are fine. I think that there's a huge difference between recommended daily allowance, which tends to be effectively how much you need, not necessarily how much is going to be optimal, and then a toxic dose. Like, there is a huge difference between those. So if you go over your RDA, probably no difference. There's still, like, miles and miles and miles before you reach a dose that would be toxic. But most of the research is around, like, it's effective, like, a minimal effective dose as opposed to what's optimal for people to have. So that's why, like, I think the recommended daily allowance of vitamin D is something like 5 IU, or, like, it's tiny. But most people take, like, I think I take 3,000.
Okay.
Right. Next question from Bobby. I know we are to take rest days seriously, but do you believe in active rest days, yoga, steps, nice big stretch? Let's answer that one first.
Nice
big stretch.
Taking rest days seriously.
Take this seriously. I want you to lie there and not do anything, okay? Read a book. That's as exciting as it's allowed to get. Do I believe in active rest days? I mean, it depends. Like if you were like, I'm going to hike up a mountain, and you weren't really someone that did that, then that's not an active rest day, is it, really? But like a nice gentle walk, or like something that's like a fun activity that's not going to like make you sore or use up too much energy, then I would say that you could go for that.
I agree. I think some shoga would be good.
Some shoga would be dynamite. Shoga. And I take a really nice, gentle, relaxing, nice big stretch, Bobby, on Sunday. A lot of people take a rest day on Sunday, so come along. Okay, any tips for not entirely destroying the week over the weekend? Adherence in the week is usually okay, but I destroy it all at the weekend. Bobby is so dramatic in the way she talks. I love it. Absolutely love it.
This is unfortunately comes to some tough love for me. Time to put the big girl, big boy pants on.
Oh.
And take into account the fact that you know that the weekends is where you're destroying it. So you have to take control of that. You have to go, weekends are normally shit for me. Time I need to pull the finger out and actually start understanding and doing what I'm doing Monday to Friday. You know, there's we've spoken before about sort of saving some calories. So you've got a little bit extra calories at the weekend. But this is a 6 week program. It's, you know, we're not, you know, it's a 6 week program. If you want to get the best out of it, nail it down for 6 weeks and you'll see what you can do for 6 weeks. Like look at it as a challenge to yourself. And this is the, you know, so many people come to this question gets asked a lot. And it genuinely is, you know, a little bit of willpower, a little bit of stubbornness to yourself and just saying, do you know what? I know that I have crap weekends. I need to rein it in, because you know you're doing it yourself. So it's one of the ones that you have, it's fully within your control. This isn't something that you can, that's not out your control and you just need to, don't worry about. This is something that you can fully get both hands on and take it under your control.
Take the bull by the horns.
Horns.
Yeah, I agree. I think the way this is worded as well, it's becoming a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy of like, I always ruin it on the weekend. Yeah, because you're telling yourself you're going to ruin it on the weekend. That also doesn't help. Plan ahead. Like, what are the social events I want to have on this weekend? And then choose your indulgences. That doesn't mean a whole weekend of eating crap. That means, right, I'm still going to have a pretty structured breakfast and lunch, and then I've saved up a couple of couple hundred calories, so I'm gonna have a couple of beers with my, you know, quite healthy takeaway because I've made better options, but I'm still gonna enjoy that. Like, that's the kind of balance you can have for sure, but it still takes some compromise and you still have to be accountable. And I think one thing that always, or like, is a good stat to sort of remind yourself is that the weekend is like 37% of your week. If you're not paying attention to that, then you're massively missing out on progress you could make. And the other thing is, it's annoyingly easy to outdo a deficit that you've created during the week by overdoing it on the weekend, which means all that effort you put on or you put in during the week is kind of negated by the fact that you've had two takeaways on the weekend and had a load of beer and wine and stuff. Like, it still counts, unfortunately. So think of your week as that weekly average, and you know, you can play with it a bit for sure. Like, if there are things on the weekend that you want to go and enjoy and they involve consuming a few more calories, that's fine. That's great. We want you to have that balance. But you still have to be accountable to it.
Yep. Totally agree with both of you. And also, like, I'm just thinking back to when I first stopped drinking, the first weekend, alcohol-free was so hard because that was the first one. And I had to use 100% of my willpower and dedication. But then after that, like, the willpower and dedication that I needed kind of went down because I was like, okay, well, I've done it that weekend and I know what I need to do from now on in order to, like, not drink alcohol.
I think that's...
So, yeah, Bobby.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry.
I was going to say, I think that's such a good point. Like, the first time you don't sort of overeat on the weekend, like, that's probably going to be the hardest to do, but then you build this trust in yourself. Because at the moment you're feeding yourself this thing of every weekend I ruin it, and you keep telling yourself that, and inevitably you probably are going to do it. But as soon as you build trust within yourself that you can go out with your mates on the weekend and not completely blow it, and actually you can have fun without massively overeating or over drinking, and then you build that self-confidence in like your belief that you will actually stick to something that you say you're going to stick to. So what I would do is really plan the first weekend. And if you can get through this weekend, then it's going to be so much easier. But yeah, plan ahead.
Yep. Have we answered this next question? There's lots of comments underneath, but I don't see one from one of us.
Is it menopause?
Right, here we go. Yeah, shall we go for that one? Yeah?
Yes. Although someone has suggested the Fitness Unfiltered podcast with Dr. Philippa Kay. She's a menopause expert, so that's very good.
Okay. Do you want me to read out the question?
Yes.
Yep. Not seen the word menopause or perimenopause anywhere, so I'm putting it out there. It's not stopping me do anything, but I'm just wondering, with the mix of macros I'm getting, if I need to get supplements in there. I do get hip pain, mainly around hip flexors, when I get up in the morning, but I think that's more the way I sleep. That's from Laura.
I think we've got quite a few people menopausal or perimenopausal, which is great because it's probably the most important time of your life to exercise and to make sure your diet's on point. But it's also potentially for some people one of the hardest times of their life to make sure that they're on top of both of those things. So I'm really glad that you're here, because then we can support you to do so if you need extra support. The first thing we always say is go and see your GP. Like, that, there's nothing we can do on that front. And once we know what situation you are in terms of if you're taking HRT or not, then maybe there's certain things that we can suggest. But in terms of what you would do differently from any other clients that were looking to sort of optimize body composition, there's not really anything. It's just that you might need a little bit more support and it can be a little bit harder at certain times. But there's nothing like drastically different that you should be doing. You should be making sure you're resistance training. You're already doing that. You should be getting in enough protein. You're already doing that. You should be eating in a way that supports your goals, whether that is building muscle, losing fat, staying at maintenance. You're already doing that. So there isn't at the moment anything extra by purely just by the fact that you're menopausal. That might change if you have certain symptoms, which not everyone will go through, and depending on the treatments that you're given. So yeah, my first bet would be go and see your GP and see what they can do for you and have a bit of a treatment plan. But I'm sure that they will be extremely happy that you are lifting weights and looking after yourself.
Love it. Okay, so a question for, oh, do you have anything to add on that? No?
No, all good.
I heard someone do a wee, like, inhale. No, okay.
Just breathing.
stop it. Emma, if you stop training for a period of time, does your body really use muscle as an energy source before excess body fat? That's from Emma.
Oh, right. I thought you were saying, I was like, oh, is it directly at me? No.
No.
Your body's quite reluctant to get rid of lean tissue, really. But you can think of it like, this is such a simple way to look at it, but it also holds very true. Use it or lose it. If you're not using your muscle, then yeah, it probably, to an extent, like, it's not necessarily that your body's using it for energy preferentially over body fat. It's just that if you don't use it, then your body thinks that you're not using it and you don't need it, so it's not going to maintain it. Muscle is much more metabolically active than fat tissue, so it's much harder for your body to maintain muscle, and muscle is in a constant state of turnover, so it won't be maintained if it's not being stimulated. And I mean, some will be maintained, but equally you could just claim that that's being stimulated. Like, we actually lose muscle ridiculously quickly when we're completely immobile. So like when you're bedbound, or if you go into space and you don't even have gravity, you'd lose muscle very, very quickly.
Yeah, I imagine that happens quite a lot.
I mean, often on Commit to Six, when people go into space, this is something we've had to deal with quite a few times, but just extreme examples there. You will lose muscle very quickly. But the good point I want to make here is that even with quite minimal exercise, you can maintain muscle very well. So you just need to be stimulating it. So keep on stimulating.
And don't worry, since you joined Commit to Six, you're not going to be stopping training for any period of time anytime soon.
True that.
Otherwise, we will hunt you down. from Valeria, that's such a nice name. Is too much protein an issue? Noticed I'm quite high up, above 160, not even forcing myself. All right, flexor.
I'm not even trying. Do you know what's so interesting is that you'll get that, like, I'm not even trying, I think I might be eating too much protein, and then two comments down, it's like, I can't get even 80 grams of protein and I've been trying so hard. It's very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. It just depends on, like, people's habits and what they enjoy.
Probably depends, like, on what people are eating, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, but clearly she enjoys eating things that are have a lot of protein in them, so.
Yeah.
Snacking on a cow's leg. That's how I get my protein in.
Yeah, she's like, she's basically a female Andy.
Carnivore diet, maybe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I would say it's not a problem if it isn't impacting the rest of your diet and if you enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
By that, I mean if you're having 160 grams of protein, but like 5 grams of fat, not ideal. Like there's a minimum amount of fat that we need you to get in as well. Or if you're having loads and loads of protein, but you're not getting in your fruit and veg because you can't fit it in your calories, not ideal. But if you're having 160 grams of protein, but you're still hitting all the other important variables that we've spoken about, so getting in at least 6 fruit and veg a day, getting in about at least 0.5 grams per kilogram body weight on fat, but probably closer to 1 gram per kilogram body weight, that would be awesome. Like, I don't mind how much protein you're eating then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's not like an excessive amount.
No.
I think we still have this misconception of protein being bad for your kidneys and stuff, which is, we know, you know, eat, that's not an issue.
Unless you have kidney problems.
Yeah. And that's what the studies were done on, was done on people who had kidney problems, and it exacerbated that problem. I think the other thing with having, if you eat in huge amounts of protein, is that protein is generally more expensive than everything else. So if you're finding that you're running up a huge food bill, you maybe want to trim down the protein just to mm-hmm. save yourself some money. So, but as you say, there's not really an issue with it, provided you're managing to cover all your bases.
Also, mm-hmm. Hannah will be really sad.
I was going to say that it's not great for the environment to have that much protein.
Like, poor Hannah cutting down her protein from 100 grams to 70 to save the environment, and then
She's literally done it just for Valeria so that she could eat, like, offset Valeria's protein.
Here, take my grams. Yeah, right. I think that there are other considerations, but it completely depends on what you're interested in. But, like, in terms of physiologically, is it a problem if it's not impacting the rest of your diet? No. But there are other considerations you might want to make. And if you want to hear about that, I don't know what episode it was, but it was an episode with Hannah. It's very, very interesting.
Shona, encyclopedia.
I would say it's like 1.5 something. Or no,
yeah.
I think
maybe like, what about
174? Well, I guess 174.
Okay.
Right, give me a second while we just find out.
What an exciting game to play. Riveting.
Right, 1.7. Oh my god, it was!
Oh, that's actually very impressive. So, episode 174, the environmental cost of your diet, right?
Yeah, uh-huh, done. That's it. The most dedicated ESG coach isn't even ESG, it's me. Right, okay, here we go. From Mary, do you recommend taking inositol if having hormone challenges, hypothyroid?
No. But do go and see your GP because they should be able to manage that with medication. But and to give that context, as far as I know, inositol works via increasing your insulin response or your insulin sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I know, that wouldn't necessarily help hypothyroidism.
Okay, so next question. The next two have been answered. So we'll move on to Scott. I think Scott Nixon might be the new Not Tom Woods of this.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Oh, I miss Not Tom Woods.
He's definitely listening. So we miss you.
We miss you.
Okay, so Scott asks, why do muscles ache and hurt more when doing plyometrics and isometric exercises like box jumps, squat jumps, and wall sits? Is that a giant set in one of the workouts? Because that sounds, oh, Emma, you're evil.
Emma's disappearing off camera like this going, wasn't he?
I'm like, I don't train legs.
It's like Homer, it's like this, the
disappearing the into the... That always reminds me of Sarah's memes. I can't remember which one she did, but it was so good with Homer like disappearing into Oh no, it was when she'd, because she was the reason that we all did blooming cold showers.
Oh right, that's right.
And then she's like, oh sorry.
Stepping away from this now.
Okay, so that horrible giant set of box jumps, squat jumps and wall sits, than when just lifting weights. Is the stimulus different? And also, could you build muscle doing just these types of exercises?
So with plyometrics, is a lot of the sort of the pain comes from the fact that it's high impact and you're jumping around. Isometric pain comes from, or not pain, but isometric muscle burn comes from the fact that your muscle isn't being allowed to relax. So in a squat, you have a point where you're moving and you're working, and then at the top, you have a sort of relaxed point where there's the weight's still on you, but you're not putting the muscle under as much pressure. Whereas an isometric exercise like a wall sit, there is no relaxed phase. You're in the middle of the movement the whole time and you can't get away from it. As for muscle building, you will get a little bit of offshoot for muscle building, but it's not optimal. The biggest reason that we're looking at that is that you need some form of progression. So the progression is load and putting load through the muscle to be able to sort of make the adaptation for muscle to grow. Whether I apply a plyometric exercise, I would be very, very unlikely to load it, because the risk of injury is very, very high. So a plyometric exercise just purely on body weight is still quite risky, because you could fall off a box, you could shred your shins, you could go over on your ankle. Mm-hmm. And if you then chuck weight on top of that, you're just exacerbating the issue if there is an issue to arise. So you could build muscle doing it, but it's not optimal and it's going to take a lot longer to do than if you purely focus on things like loading.
Mm. Yeah, I think the only thing I would add is that I think a lot of the DOMS comes from the eccentric phase. So like when you're landing, yep, some of the plyometric movements, and it's that muscle lengthening under tension, that's where most of the muscle damage is caused. And that's what's causing delayed onset muscle soreness. Muscle damage isn't directly related to like how much muscle you're going to build.
Yeah.
Which is why we don't just do eccentric loading, for example. So the concentric phase is important as well. So that's like the up phase of a squat as opposed to the down phase of a squat. The down phase is probably causing you more damage than the up phase.
Yeah.
Okay. Loving the program so far. Just wondering what an average... is the time lag to gaining the benefits of eating higher protein, eating healthier, and resistance training combo? So what I'm eating this week, I will reap the benefits next week based on good recovery, sleep, and lowering stress, etc.
I mean, it's a piece of string, I guess.
Exactly. Like... I mean, I would say that, like, a lot of people, the moment they signed up for Commit to Six, felt a little bit better. They were like, oh, so excited that I'm making this like awesome change to my life. And the same with like all the comments in the accountability thread on day one, like people were just loving life. So yeah, as you say, how long is a piece of string? You'll start feeling benefits from the moment that you make that change. But in terms of like, I don't really know what you mean by benefits.
Yeah,
like,
there's so many different benefits. It depends what you mean by benefits. Mm-hmm. Like, do you mean when will I see the benefits? And you can make a huge change in 6 weeks,
mm-hmm,
for sure. But you can literally change your whole life in 6 months. And I think we need to worry less about like how long these things are going to take. You'll certainly feel, most people probably feel better already. But by next week, you might also be feeling a bit more energized. Mm-hmm. And you might be noticing that you've got more energy, or that you're doing push-ups, yeah, better, or that, you know, you're less hungry because you're actually fueling your body as opposed to binge restrict cycles and things like that. So immediately, but also it might take a while to see those differences, but equally that also depends. Like some people see quite a big difference in a week. Other people, yeah, don't see much difference in 6 weeks, but it maybe depends how much you have to lose.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay, Helen, I can't do deep squats due to limited range of motion after my hip replacement a few years ago. Does this matter? Will I still get the benefit?
squatting within your range of movement. It's as simple as that. Like, you know, there was always this argument about squatting ass to grass. It's the only way to squat. Well, that's not the case at all. You know, if you have a limited movement, you can only work with a limited movement. So you just do with what you've got. Something simple like with hip replacement, you might find a nice little position to help alleviate the position is to elevate your heels. So potentially standing on like a 1.25 or a 2.5 kilo weights plate just allows your, with the lift of the heel, just allows your knees to travel in the direction you need to go. And that's generally what it is. I've now, one of my clients has had two knee replacements. He's got lifting shoes now, and his range of motion is like ridiculous for somebody who's had two knee replacements. I've coached somebody who has had a hip replacement, and it was generally just getting them to that slight heel raise on a set of plates, provided everything's stable, is allowing the knees and the hips to translate and move in the position they need to go. So that's maybe something that you maybe want to have a look at.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, I would say you certainly don't need to stress about doing full depth squats as well. Like, I actually think if you're not a powerlifter, there's not particularly not much point doing them.
Yeah.
And the injury risk is quite high. And if I'd had, like, I mean, I don't intend to probably ever do them again because I don't see the point, given that the injury risk for me would far outweigh the benefit I'm going to get from it. That might be the same for you with your hip replacement, or like you might find that you can do those movements given the right situations and the right movement patterns. But I wouldn't let it hold you back. And like the whole time I did athletics, we never squatted below half squat, and the best legs I've ever had, but also all my training partners have ever had. Like, it's not like you couldn't develop great legs without doing full squats. It was just the risk to injury was way more than like the benefit that we were going to get from going full squat.
Yeah. Okay. So from Kirsten, contrary to what I have always believed, the workouts are for training muscles, building strength, counteracting the effects of aging, improving bone density, especially in women of my age, etc. And the fat loss happens through the steps, general activity, NEAT, and so on.
Yes, it's, gal.
Yes.
Preach.
Right, okay. So
say it louder.
Well done. Where does cardio exercise, for example, boot camp style sessions, fall on this scale? I will incorporate one or two a week for the enjoyment factor, but was wondering what the other benefits are. I think that's such a good question. Don't you?
Yeah, I mean, all exercise has benefits.
Yeah.
Like, you're still going to get huge benefits, and especially if it's a boot camp, like, you're still probably going to stimulate some muscle as well to build, and you'll be working your cardiovascular health in many aspects, or your cardiovascular system, and you will burn more calories than if you were sitting on the couch. Like, it's not that exercise doesn't burn calories, it's just that that's not necessarily why we're doing it, and it's not the most important aspect of doing a workout, and you're going to get far more in terms of managing your calorie or your managing your energy balance by looking at your activity over the full day. And I mean, you can include exercise in that. It's your energy output over the full day, including how much you exercise, and your energy input from food. So you need to look at that in terms of fat loss as like a bigger picture overarching view. And then the exercise you do, it's for fitness, it's for enjoyment, it's great that you're enjoying boot camps, that's awesome, and it's for building muscle.
I think we similarly to everybody overlooking the goal of being of vanity, I think we've always forget the fact that the enjoyment factor of training, if you enjoy it, you will stick and you will keep doing it. If you hate it, it's the first thing that goes, it's the first thing that disappears. So we always, if you enjoy it, I had that from a one-to-one client this week. Oh, I'd really like to put a HIIT class in. I'm like, and she goes, is there a benefit to it? I go, yeah, there's a benefit to it. You're going to get increased cardiovascular function because you're obviously going to be working. You're going to burn some calories, but do you enjoy them? Yeah. Well, put a HIIT session in. We can put that in, factor it in, because you enjoy it. Like, in training, the enjoyment of training is a massive.
What a psycho.
I know. I was like, somebody, it's like folk that program burpees, Emma. you crazy swine, you.
I love burpees.
Yeah. Oh, man. I think the reason is because I have to do mine in stages. That's like, it's like watching a tree be cut down. That's pretty much
one
what
of
I'm...
my. I remember one client like seeing or like observing this. I guess she's like, sometimes you put exercises in and they're actually about 5 exercises in one. And I'm like, yeah, it's like if you look at like a man maker or like bear complex or something, like effectively it's just numerous exercises in one move.
Emma's going, see what I did there?
It's just one exercise. Jeez.
Last Saturday was the day where I had to stop doing chest to floor burpees and I was a little bit sad.
Is that because your chest doesn't reach the floor because of the bump now?
Yeah, that's why. And so now I have to do like MetaFit burpees where you just jump out and then jump back in. And I was a little bit sad.
Aww. I mean, it's not going to be long now.
No, you're right. Like, I'll give birth and then do a burpee in celebration.
Is maybe, that not how you maybe get, not a great idea.
Is that not how the baby comes out? Burpees.
That's going to be my birthing position.
One of Laura and Shona's friends is currently pregnant. She's due in, I think, about 2 weeks' time. And she was like, oh, the baby's head's fit, that's the wrong way around. And I'm like, oh, so what do you do for that then? And she's like, you just bounce around on a Swiss ball. And I'm like, what? Just randomly bounce around? I'd be worried that in case it fell out.
Andy.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. It
unfortunately,
doesn't work like that.
That's not how bad.
No, it's not.
Yeah,
how
sometimes it just falls out. Although,
that Carlsberg advert was lying.
Do you remember the stories that used to go around when you were younger? And it was like, it would be like in the Daily Mail or something. It's like, somebody gives birth during their GCSE exam. And they're like, oh my God, I didn't even know I was pregnant. And you're like how did you just like.
That's Jerry McHale stuff, that one.
That happened to Sonia in EastEnders.
See? Legit. What, she didn't know she was pregnant?
Yeah, that was the storyline. She went to the toilet and gave birth.
See, that kind of stuff, I'm like, what?
It happens.
Well, if it happened in EastEnders.
Well, the Daily Mail said that as well. You know, the Daily Mail are the truth.
Yeah, do you know, I would, based on my experience of pregnancy, I'm like, how could you not know? Like, you must be, like, you know how... Some people just don't know what feeling good feels like. So.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. I just can't.
Oh, my stomach looks like there's a foot coming out of it. I wonder what that is.
But also, like, puking up every day for, like, 12 weeks. Surely you would question that and go to the doctor, no?
Sarah's saying that her friend found out at 8.5 months that she was pregnant.
I've heard of that as well.
Holy shit.
How could you prepare?
We've got to get this nursery done. It's going to take us 2 weeks to get this done.
Totally mental. Andy, I actually blew up my Swiss ball yesterday to bounce on it.
Blew up to, or not, sat on it and exploded. No? That's definitely a YouTube moment, that one.
Yeah. I'll tell you one more story before we move on to answering questions. My friend who is doing my maternity photo shoot for me, saw me in our car park workout, and he said, when are we going to do this photo shoot? If we don't do it soon, I'm going to have to order a bigger backdrop.
Ooh.
Oh, you cheeky man.
Cheeky bastard. Did you throw a kettlebell at him?
No. Right, okay. So
No.
No.
Right, okay, let's answer another question from the... Emma. I'm just wondering if it's too early to drop the C-bomb. Creatine. but she hasn't actually asked the question, so we'll move on swiftly. So, from Lisa. My goal is muscle building, partly for aesthetic reasons, but also I have performance goals, pull-ups, press-ups, heavier squats, deadlift, etc. And currently on the push-pull leg split. I'm a little limited on upping weight right now, but once the gym opens, would it be better to incorporate some 5x5 rep sets for compound movements? If so, how often? I would say, Lisa, this might be the time to like think about one-to-one coaching, especially if you've got like specific goals like that. Like, we could say, yeah, add in the odd 5x5, but like past that, What do you think?
I mean, given her goals, like, the gym programming is going to be more than enough.
Right, okay.
Like, 5x5 isn't, there's nothing special about that particularly. Yeah. Like, yeah. I think you will get a huge amount from the programming that's programmed.
Yeah, totally.
So I would just stick to that.
Yeah, Emma's been doing this for a very long time, and she knows how to make people stronger and build muscle. So
kind
don't
of what
worry.
I do.
Kind of what she does.
I think it is one of those ones, though, that I think people do get that kind of mixed up part of looking at like things like sets and reps and going, I can, if I only do 3 reps, I'm not going to get bigger, I'm going to get stronger. When in actual fact, there's quite a runoff across all of them. You'll get stronger doing 8 to 12 reps, which is generally your hypertrophy or hypertrophy or so you'll get that sort of runoff over the lot of them. So the programs that are designed and up on the app for you, get stuck in about them, mm-hmm. and you'll see, you'll make the gains.
Yeah, 100%.
Jenna, how many more questions do we have?
One, two.
I think it's one, is it?
Five or six. Five or six, what do you think?
Can we, I think we should split the podcast.
Okay.
Going to make an executive decision here. Once we get over an hour, I think people might start getting bored.
What happened to you saying that on Sunday?
That was when the live, Shona. That was very important information. Of course it was going to be longer.
It's going to be longer, and you needing a pee just didn't help.
I'm sorry.
Unprofessional. No, I'm joking.
It was massively unprofessional.
Have a bottle close by. That's what this is for.
Oh.
Pop it on mute. You're fine.
Or a policeman's hat.
Yeah. Okay, well, that was lovely. Thanks, guys. Andy, do you want to do the outro?
Say it again.
Do you want to do the outro?
I'll do the outro, but we need to get yourself on and rate our podcast. If you want to have a look at any one-to-one, commit to section like that, esgfitness.co.uk, and our outro is, go fuck yourself.